The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Hi. You know, I don't know what it is today. I like giving talks, and I like speaking to people. I like having all of your attention, to be honest. You can affirm me. But today I'm a little bit nervous, and I think I'm nervous because of the fact that I feel like this history has a lot of stakes. For me, it's not something we all know about. It's something from which we can draw a lot of lessons. It's also been hard to mine out all the information that I possibly could. But I guess with that said, let me kind of get into the text of my talk. I'm sorry I won't get to make all the eye contact I want to. I've really written this all out just to really be meticulous about it. So bear with me. Welcome to our talk on transgender history and politics. I once again this year feel totally honored to be with such a beautiful crowd of people, and I hope to get to know a bunch of you after we're done discussing this history for a while, after this session when we have an half an hour break, and then in the evening as well, where I'll be really conspicuously drinking on the patio. Join me. As I was thinking about this talk, it occurred to me that a lot of history talks, while very informative, don't necessarily translate into a deeper understanding when we're confronted with political situations. So in presenting this history, I want you all to think of it as an organizer's talk, as a series of historical points that help us contextualize the principles we should have, as well as the contradictions we have to navigate in our fight for a society free from oppression. Some questions that I think will come up for us are, and these are very general, but you'll see how they're concrete later, I think. What are the issues that most affect trans communities? What kinds of reforms should we fight for? How should we understand the moment today referred to by Time magazine as the trans tipping point? All the political questions I discuss today are multi-sided, and so, you know, I think like a lot of what I'm trying to do is unpack how things are good and bad, how they're complicated, and they have to be understood in a contextual way. Anyway, I guess I want to begin with a point about gender today, because it's clear that the mainstream of American society has seen a shift. And I'll say this to that, like, that what we're witnessing today is not just the realization of a truth about gender that's already been there. People aren't just coming out and saying what they've repressed their whole lives, although repression is certainly a part of it. Instead, what we are seeing is a process of change, of the development and transformation of gender as a human social practice in real time. New forms of gender that have the potential to mean greater freedom. And I think that given the collective nature of this moment, we should recognize that we're all participants in this change, that the fight over whether or not transness will continue to be a mark of violence, exclusion, objectification, the fight is over, whether it can be those things, or if trans can mean something else, this is a fight that has to continue. Something about the media discourse on the tipping point I find difficult is the way it's been detached from the history of trans struggle, trans radicalism, and identification with the urgency of resistance to oppression. And thus it's not merely enough to accept, not enough to tolerate. Gender continues to be a site of some of the most intimate forms of oppression, and we must therefore fight to shape ourselves and our gender conception, honestly, in terms of a history of resistance and self-determination. So that's to say that whatever it is we call gender is something that changes historically and is shaped most of all by the conditions under which we live and how it's changed through the course of struggle. Perhaps most of all, it's worth saying that the vision of emancipation we have today in terms of what gender could mean in a really liberated society is a direct consequence of the history and struggle we're covering in this talk. We couldn't imagine what we're fighting for without the development of struggles that have shaped that vision itself. Anyway, in terms of structure, I'm going to begin with a sort of longer-term series of points about the... Actually, I'm cutting that, so ignore that. I'm going to talk about three things, basically. The relationship between medicine and gender, the politics of inclusion, and struggles against racism, policing, and urban poverty. In my original version of this talk, and this is why I just stumbled for you, I had a longer discussion of the legal institutionalization of the gender binary in the US and the way it was tied up so that homosexuality and transgenderism were not necessarily separate, but were coming under attack and are sort of divided over the course of this. It's interesting history. Peter Drucker's Warped covers some of it. I recommend the book. So I'm going to have to skip over it to get to later history, but I just want to flag that, you know, it's with the development of industrial capitalism, at least in the United States, that gender policing becomes more rigorous. due to the way different forms of life were made possible as working class people were concentrated in cities and communal living situations. And in the US, this happens predominantly in the 19th century. There's another history of gender policing capitalism that has to do with colonialism, but we don't have time to talk about that either. Sorry. And I think it's important, so maybe someday. In much of the history of gender that's come to appear to us today, trans expression has been mediated by the possibility of medical intervention, whether this has been speech therapy, hormones, or surgical intervention as some key modalities of it. Briefly, I just want to say that much of what follows here I attribute to Susan Stryker's wonderful new edition of her book, Transgender History. This is an invaluable book. Really, truly. It's political, it's historical, it's all the shit you want it to be and more. So I think in general, science and medicine have a double effect. They can be used to justify reactionary ideologies, enact violence on people's bodies, and take away the very important capacity for decision making about one's life and what one does. At the same time, of course, developments in medical technology have meant an almost unaccountable number of beneficial transformations for human life in general, including, of course, in the specificities of trans life. Thus, the history of relationship of medicine to trans experience is ambivalent, one of necessity, but also of deep violence and oppression. In the 19th century, medical practitioners, attempted to in particular, to decode or develop a language for the new gender practices that were emerging. Probably the time when this happens in a sort of positive advocacy kind of way is around Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, founder of sexology and the Institute for Sexual Science in Berlin. His writings beginning in the last decade of the 19th century and into the first few of the 20th, he's alive for a while, inaugurated the possibility of a very different accepting attitude around the understanding of trans experience. He was also a leading figure of the World League for Sexual Reform, itself deeply connected to the socialist and communist movements, and ultimately torn apart by differences between the left and the right. Also interesting history we can't talk too much about. But Berlin became, by the 1930s, a home for some of the most progressive ideas in the world around gender. There's an enormous subculture, underground culture of, where gender expression, non-normative gender expression was able to blossom, and so the study of it in support of the medical physical needs of these people also blossomed, and so they would be able to give a lead to advocates worldwide, including in the U.S. Importantly, Hirschfeld would help train Harry Benjamin, who would become the leading advocate for affirmative surgery in the United States. Of course, this is not just the effect of Hirschfeld. Rather, Hirschfeld represents these broader changing attitudes. Isn't just something I'm saying about it. In fact, Hirschfeld came under the scrutiny of the growing Nazi movement, and Hitler would refer to Hirschfeld as a gay socialist, as the most dangerous Jew in Germany, for the kinds of associations and activities and vision he had about the work he was doing. The result of this was that the incredible trove of resources and research covered by Hirschfeld was lost when his work was destroyed by Nazis, a tragic loss for the history of trans people in the West. Many of you have probably seen an iconic image of a Nazi book burning. It's Hirschfeld's collections at the Institute for Sexual Research that's being burned. Back in the United States in 1949, an affiliate of early trans activist Louise Lawrence became entangled in a legal case. The case rested in part on the legitimacy of transsexual genital modification in relation to whether engaging in such a surgery could leave a surgeon liable to criminal prosecution for mayhem, defined as quote-unquote mayhem, defined as willfully damaging healthy tissue. This represented an enormous setback, as in the following decade, very few doctors were willing to supply medical procedures sought out by trans people. And when they did, it was an LA-based doctor, an associate of Harry Benjamin's, who performed them secretly. It would take a decade and a half, during which time there was a substantial increase of transgender community building and organizing for medical access to become more available. The greater level of organization meant also an increasing connection between the Langley Porter Clinic at UCLA and later a clinic at Johns Hopkins to burgeoning transgender communities for what we'd refer to now as transition-related care. Meanwhile, this would result in a new apparatus of state regulation, with laws by the second half of the 20th century requiring that access to hormones and surgeries require that individuals live as the gender with which they identify for years before they could even have access to transition-related care. One can imagine how dangerous it is to, you know, be living in the middle of the 20th century presenting as visibly trans and not able to, you know, to deal with this in any way, like how that could limit the possibility of continuing to do that long enough to the point where you could get access. And this is a history that continues even to today. Access to hormone replacement therapy right now still requires the certification of a therapist, and there remain fairly strictly controls by the medical establishment over who and how people get hormones, in particular testosterone, which is listed as a controlled substance. I get this a lot in my job working, I do trans health. The process for acquiring surgery is even more intensive, often lasting years, requiring numerous physical and psychiatric evaluations. And this comes out of a long history, one that involves the psychiatric pathologization of gay and trans people, and in particular their treatment as psychotics. Thus, contemporary gatekeeping is performed by the same institutions which decades ago engaged in violent and unsympathetic treatment, forced hospitalization, and the other more quotidian forms of abuse that take place in inpatient clinics all around the world today and historically. So medical resources have long been kept out of reach for many trans people and has been a right to be fought for. And the medical establishment is in no way part of this process of limiting access. So as medical intervention has become woven into the fabric of transgender practice then, it's done so in ways that have not always been strictly for the purposes of actualizing the self-determination of trans individuals and communities. It's important for us to understand that people transition for all kinds of reasons, often very personal and private. But social processes are also deeply important to this, and the pressures to fight for inclusion are a central way practices of gender and transition are shaped. But, of course, violence, limited access to stable working class employment and public life in general, as well as the social pressure that pushes people to see sex work as one of their only options to make a living, all place a high premium on being able to appear cis and to take on a normative presentation of one's gender. Medical access thus becomes valuable not only as a way of expressing gender identity, but also a practice for safety, security, and access to broader social inclusion. People who are visibly trans or flout gender norms, whether or not they identify as trans themselves, thus face the brunt of social oppression that we call transphobia, in particular if their accesses to resources that might allow them to pass are limited by geographic, racial, or class position. Access to public spaces like bathrooms is a key site of trans oppression, and it's under contention today. Indeed, whether or not someone has access to a restroom that can be used safely is a major decider of where one can and cannot go, and thus to what extent it is possible to live as a trans person in public space. And it's public space that we're and public life and the ability to live out in the world that's at stake here. For many middle-class, mostly white people, this meant that the early communities that they formed would be built around. 10 minutes left. Okay, would be built around creating enclaves of acceptance where people could come together to cross-dress, or where small networks of individuals who were living full-time as trans would forge very private correspondence networks. But with a general isolation overarching, these networks of correspondence. Some people tried to carve out a space of identification that would accommodate itself to existing norms, mainly through excluding certain groups. And probably the first organization of trans people was one like this, in the US anyway. It was organized by Virginia Prince, herself born from a prominent Los Angeles family and associated with the Langley Porter Clinic, where I mentioned earlier the major source of trans care in these early years. Prince, however, was rather disdainful of gay people, had strongly stereotyped views of masculinity and femininity, and was not always supportive of surgical intervention herself. By the 1950s, Prince would start a group that began a newsletter, Transvestia, the journal of the American Society for Equality in Dress, distributed among a network that had been built around the Langley Porter Clinic and its leading activist, also someone I mentioned earlier, Louise Lawrence. For these individuals, transvestism was defined as a specific practice of heterosexual men, and it was distinguished sharply from the practice of drag, associated with gay communities. They would also distinguish themselves sharply from those who were able to get surgery, like the first publicly prominent transsexual, Christine Jorgensen. Susan Stryker points out here, though, of course, that as with many struggles against oppression, trans organization first emerges from those who are most privileged and whose demands are often the most limited. Maybe put differently, some of us can hope to be included more easily than others, and those that can do so will often be the first to try. But we can't ignore this history either. Virginia Prince would come under attack from the government after engaging in a romantic and sexual correspondence with another woman who self-presented as a lesbian. She was eventually prosecuted for the crime of distributing obscenity through the U.S. mail. Clearly, Prince's role as someone resisting, in however small way, the strict regime of gender norms so important in the 1950s drew her under scrutiny and led to her being attacked by a state interested in the policing and maintaining of these rigid norms. At the same time, however, her relative prominence, a result of her work publishing and organizing a transvestite community, allowed her to plead to a lesser charge and was able to, meant she was able to avoid a prison sentence. Prince would continue to organize, always on a racially and class-limited basis, and always to the exclusion of gays and transsexuals for the rest of her life. The other side of the story, happening at the same time, though, is very different. And it's one rooted in a history that's initially rather separate from clubs and magazines and surgeries, at least at first. Around the country, during the late 40s and into the 50s, with the explosions of urban migration, the great migration of black people from the South, and which happened, earlier, but, the sort of industrialization deepens here, and thus the birth of new and larger urban and multiracial life, one process of spatial marginalization among many was the production of what might be termed gay ghettos. In these places, people with non-normative gender and sexual identities would find themselves herded, as police would pick up visibly gay and trans individuals, and particularly people of color, and direct them to these neighborhoods. Often these would be vice neighborhoods where drug use and dealing as well as prostitution would be tolerated is probably not exactly the right word, because there's all kinds of continuing violence taking place at all times, but they were herded into specific areas. It's in places like these in particular that the systematic pushing of trans people into sex work takes place en masse, and with corrupt and violent police, poverty, and exposure to illness, these places, like other urban spaces where oppressed people were condensed, became increasingly boiling points where resistance eventually had to break out. This is where the history of militant struggle and the ideas of trans liberation find their origins. These communities represented something vastly different, tied much more closely to gay history, and articulating trans identity through terms like queen, which encompassed a wider range of forms of gender presentation than the narrowly exclusive category transvestite. Okay. The associated culture, particularly balls with their celebration of gender subversion and decidedly queer sexuality, represents a strong counterpoint, again, to the exclusionary history of the work in organizations led by someone like Virginia Prince. Not the first, but an extremely significant event took place in Philadelphia in 1965 at an institution frequented by queer people of color, primarily Dewey's. Public spaces such as these were necessary for precariously housed individuals, many of whom worked nights because these were places where individuals could come, find safely cheap food and community after hours when bars had closed. There, a change of ownership meant harassment and the eventual turning away of over 150 patrons on one night. Three teenagers spontaneously began to sit in there in what Susan Stryker suggests is the first act of civil disobedience over transgender discrimination in the United States. More sit-ins and an informational picket about the place's treatment of gender variant people followed, and the struggle successfully cowed the new management. They were able to continue to use the place as they had been. Stryker points out here the way that this emerges alongside the emergence of the civil rights movement, which shared the tactic of lunch counter sit-ins, and this is thematic for this generation of struggle. Trans political resistance emerges in the context of social resistance worldwide that is represented from the period going from the late 50s all the way through the mid-70s. Prior to Stonewall, the most significant moment of trans resistance occurs in the Tenderloin, San Francisco, at Compton's cafeteria. And the Tenderloin is a vice neighborhood of the kind I mentioned earlier. Resisting a police attempt to kick out a group of young queens at the restaurant who had been called by management, a fight broke out with the restaurant's patrons beating back the police with heavy handbags and stilettos, and were able to do so successfully. And what a great detail. Compton's is in particular significant for its leading to longer-term political struggle. The push against abuse in jail for Queens and trans women, solitary confinement, a torturous so-called situation that, as with a lot of the issues I'm discussing, continues as a huge problem affecting incarcerated trans women today. Sudden raids by the police, as well as for the greater dedication of funds for anti-poverty programs, all marked new and important arenas for sustained struggle. Residents in the Tenderloin launched a grassroots campaign for economic justice in 1965, building relationships to surrounding working class and poor communities of color, and persuading them that a portion of a limited allocation of federal poverty funds, which was set to go to a certain number of neighborhoods, should include the Tenderloin as one of those neighborhoods. And this, you know, essentially led to the first multiracial gay-straight alliance for economic justice in U.S. history. Harry Benjamin, during this period, released a new book, The Transsexual Phenomenon, which proved to be groundbreaking in once again opening the possibility of providing gender-affirming medical intervention. Benjamin was also present around the Tenderloin, told stories of people living there, and helped facilitate access to hormone and surgical treatments, a possibility which itself perhaps functioned as an impetus to struggle and fight for a better life. And then, of course, there's Stonewall. And I don't want to say too much about the event itself, because a lot of you know it. You can also find out about it pretty easily. But it's worth saying first that alongside the history of gay organizing that happens in New York City leading up to the event, you know, Compton's and Dewey's, although they occur at a geographical remove from New York, constitute some of the important backdrop to the Stonewall Rebellion as well, where a similar diversity of people with non-normative sexual and gender practices grew tired of police harassment and fought back night after night. Some of you may have heard chants of protests or assertions about how Stonewall was a trans riot. The acknowledgement is important because nowadays, you know, a corporatized gay rights movement, sometimes referred to as Gay Inc., presents I'm reading this and I'm like forgetting where all my little pause points are, but you should laugh at that. Yeah. they deserve to be laughed at. Presents LGBT history in the context of a narrative of steady process, a progress, and liberal acceptance, with that increasing commonplace of a happy image of the married cis gay white male couple. Against that, we can and should frame our discussions in terms of very oppressed people leading a fight to push back and doing so in the language of solidarity and revolution. While this can sometimes lead to a fetishism about who threw the first brick, in order to say something about what identities are most important, I agree with trans poet and writer Chrysanthemum Tran when she says, we need to look at the legacies of organizing that followed upon that momentous event and begin to uncover the history, that history for ourselves as well. So this gets me to my last section. I hope I'm okay on time. I have 1 minute. Okay, I'm gonna go a little bit over, I'm sorry. There's much to uncover in this history, and Katie will cover some of this too, but one important legacy for us to draw on is that of the New York-based group STAR, Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries. Founded by lifelong activists Sylvia Rivera and Marsha Payette Nomayan Johnson. STAR's work crossed a number of different terrains of struggle. Some of it was organizing an intentional and politicized space for street queens and other queer sex workers to find a safe and supportive home. This they called the STAR House. And this is one example of a long history of the role of social reproduction, the work of keeping ourselves alive that has played an important organizing role in the trans community. Mentorship, shelter, food and friendship are all necessities of life, but in the context of organizing, they also take on a deeply political role. So on the other side of this, self-defense against bashers and the police, as well as organized resistance, played an important role. In fact, STAR's first public demonstration was at an anti-police demo held by the Puerto Rican Revolutionary Nationalist Organization, the Young Lords, of which Sylvia Rivera was a member. And STAR was connected to much other revolutionary organizing of the era, with relationships to the Black Panther Party and Huey Newton in particular, the Gay Liberation Front, as well as with left-wing lesbian organizing, at least for a time, and Katie will get into some of the things that happened later. But STAR also came to an end in the context of the fractiousness of the 1970s. By 1973, at the second Christopher Street Liberation Day rally, Rivera was stopped from speaking and physically attacked by lesbian separatists transphobically accusing her of parodying womanhood. She eventually climbed up front and denounced the direction of the emerging gay movement for its willingness to give in to assimilationism and reformism. Looking back from today, Sylvia's speech clearly connects to the class and identity tensions that have long existed in the LGBT movement. One need only look at the situation of Gay Inc. for evidence. And while Sylvia would herself withdraw for some time from politics due to this experience, many trans people would continue to participate and shape this period of struggle, which was completely confused with the spirit of the era for better and for worse. So from the 1970s, there is also an important legacy of radicalism and solidarity from the feminism and gay liberation movements that we can and must learn from. And Katie here will take us through that history, as well as what it all means to be Marxist today.
Thanks for the setup. No pressure, I better deliver. Let's see, I'm going to read really fast because I'm nervous as hell and we're short on time and I want to make it. Oh, stop. No. Makes it worse. No. All right. But I'm going to pick up the thread. In the 1970s after Stonewall, because this was an important decade for trans politics. Just as it was no accident that trans struggle grew alongside the rise of other struggles, the overlap of which we see clearly in the Stonewall Rebellion, it's similarly no accident that the defeat and decline of most left struggles by the mid-1970s affected trans struggles too, negatively. Yeah. Duh, right, okay. But this period is also important because it continues to shape how trans liberation is discussed, framed, and fought for today, and not always in positive ways, especially in relation with two movements with which trans politics are most commonly associated, but from which they are distinct, and that's the gay liberation and feminist movements. So first, I'm going to make a couple of distinctions, and then I'll get to the history and politics. It's important to understand that the queer movement, I'm using queer as an umbrella term, and y'all can talk to me later if you have questions about why I use trans as an umbrella term. We'll get there. But the distinctions, I think it's important to note that even though the queer movement has been the site of much of the struggle for trans liberation is not centered on sexuality. It is a struggle instead for self-determination against the oppression dished out to anyone whose gender expression, regardless of their sexual identity, is deemed outside what is valued as the social norm. So non-binary, trans, intersex, genderqueer, and genderfluid people can be heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, asexual, or even the perennially left-swipeable sapiosexual. Y'all know what I mean. And they may or may not be part of the movement as well for sexual liberation. But unless we resist the automatic coupling of trans bodies with sexuality, we risk falling into the same fetishization of these bodies, of our bodies, as only sexual or primarily sexual, rather than as fully realized, social, sexual, professional, political, equal in all entitlements to rights and space and respect, human bodies. Y'all quit, I only got 20 minutes. Blushing. Since it's a fight against, the struggle for trans liberation is a fight against gender oppression, it would appear to be a necessary concern of the feminist movement. And I think it should be, and I'm going to argue that it should be, that it must be. But that movement is not frequently characterized as including or even supporting trans liberation, and a look at the 1970s can help us understand why that is. Three events or moments of 1973 in particular represent opportunities for the queer and feminist movements to embrace trans politics as part of a sexual and gender liberation that were either not taken or were actively opposed. First is the gay liberation movement's successful fight to have homosexuality removed from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual as a mental illness. It's a huge victory against shame and for sexual liberation. Historian Susan Stryker writes that while this liberated gaze from the burden of psychopathology, homosexual and transgender communities no longer had a common interest in working to address how they were each treated by the mental health establishment. Whereas over the previous century, the close medical and legal association of sexual and gender variants had created a shared oppression and thus a common interest among queers and trans people in fighting, this shift allowed for disidentification between these two struggles. At the same time, the relative sexual and gender freedom of the 60s and 70s counterculture also began to shift, with gay male fashion moving away from fairy chic and hippie and fairy chic towards a more masculine and even hyper-masculine, hello, Tom of Finland, style, and lesbian styles were moving towards an androgyny that was hostile to traditionally expressed masculinity and femininity, no matter who embodied it. The second event of 1973 that could have been an opportunity for solidarity with trans struggles was the struggle for reproductive justice that resulted in that year's Roe v. Wade decision. Another huge victory for bodily self-determination and autonomy. Multiple commenters note that the trans liberation movement's politics towards the medical establishment were more like the movement for reproductive freedom than gay liberation in fighting for access to quality care without stigma pathologization and for bodily autonomy and self-determination. Yet the feminist movement failed to connect to trans people's parallel struggles, partly because of feminist hostility, a current of feminist hostility to trans people, which brings us to the rise of separatism, especially lesbian separatism, as a current within radical feminism. And while this current built a bridge between lesbians and straight cis women, its influence also served to narrow the space for women's gender expression. Gender variants like butch femme, trans, and bisexuality were cast as inherently reactionary outgrowths of patriarchal gender expression and regimes of sexual desire. This is the birth of the TERFs. Okay, so I don't need to unpack trans exclusionary radical feminists. We don't like them. We'll get there in a second. But here are just three moments of that shift that marked these tensions. One, in San Francisco, two pride marches were organized, one hostile to drag and trans, and one hostile to lesbian separatism, and neither one of them particularly welcoming to our trans sisters, trans brothers, and genderqueer others. And this is utterly disloyal to the rebels at Stonewall. But this hostility to gender variance has persisted through Pride. We saw some of that in London today.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll get there. In New York City, so number two, in New York City, Sylvia Rivera was prevented from speaking at the commemoration of the rebellion she helped create. Three, at the West Coast Lesbian Conference, a gathering of over 100 lesbian organizations, separatists rushed the stage to prevent Beth Elliott, a trans lesbian activist and musician, from performing. And the conference's keynote speaker, Robin Morgan, rewrote her 45-minute speech to lay into Beth Elliott in particular, calling her a man and a rapist. These are charges we continue to encounter today among the TERFs. The point is that 1973 indicated a shift within the movement towards the policing of the definitions of lesbianism, similarly in the gay movement about who got to be gay and what they needed to look like. But this was policing the definitions of lesbianism and womanhood and the reactionary bioessentialism in radical clothing that is so often and inaccurately associated today with radical and lesbian feminism. They claim it, they can't have it. But it's important to understand that while influential, this is not only a minority current, it's never been essential to these feminisms. So I'm sidebar on the TERFs now. In case anyone is unclear, and I don't think y'all are, but in case, or you can tell your friends, these so-called radical and so-called gender critical feminists, they're not feminists at all. And they are not our sisters, and they are not our comrades. To paraphrase Holly Lewis, real radical feminists are just feminists who are really serious about fighting gender oppression. We welcome them. We do not welcome TERFs. The primary political commitment of these so-called radical, so-called feminist troglodytes is to outing and condemning trans women and excluding them from feminist spaces. But no matter how they dress it up, their categories are based exclusively on the reproductive body and its genital configuration. No matter how they dress it up, their language is identical to the harassment and outing of trans people by alt-right trash like Milo Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter, and to the Christian conservatives who like to make laws to keep trans people from being able to pee in peace. No matter how they dress it up or in how much flannel, Kathy Brennan, no offense to flannel, Kathy Brennan, Janice Raymond, and their goblin army of bad haircuts and worse politics are just as committed, they are just as committed to the genital premise of the gender binary as any Bible-thumping bigot or alt-right fascist, and they have no place in any movement against gender oppression or on this planet. End sidebar. Back to the history. This decade, so the 70s saw the decline of the broad left and the rise of neoliberalism, and it's here we see a retreat of queer and feminist politics, largely into the academy, and towards either a liberal posture of accommodation or a high theoretical radicalism with little instrumental power. And we see the transliberation struggle push further into the margins, with networks maintained by courageous individuals from outside the centers of other struggles, as Fanon mentioned. There are some bright spots, like the brief existence of transgender Nation in San Francisco in the early 90s, but Susan Strecker notes that the backlash against 1970s victories in gay liberation and feminism fell on trans people the hardest. She writes, the intensified interest in trying to understand, engineer, and fix gender in these years needs to be seen in part as an attempt to stuff the feminist genie back into its bottle. The result for transgender people was a lose-lose situation. All across the political spectrum, from reactionary to progressive, and all points in between, the only options presented to them were to be considered bad, sick, or wrong. Consequently, transgender communities became very inwardly focused by the 1980s. They tended to concentrate more on providing mutual aid and support to their members than on broader social activism. And then came AIDS, the AIDS crisis beginning in the 1980s. This is the more depressing part. We'll get to the break. Not only were trans people caught in the Reagan administration's hostile and queerphobic indifference, they were also overlooked in their specific needs for care. Trans women were erased into the men having sex with men category, and trans men were all but invisible, even where AIDS community care was provided. And where data were collected. Hormone injection, the need to rely on sex work in order to live, and unprotected sex within the gay community also made trans people more vulnerable to infection. The combination of neglect, stigma, and risk, particularly among poor and working class trans people, has resulted in this situation where trans people today are 49 times more likely to be HIV positive than the general population. Later in the 1990s and up to now, the rise of third-wave feminism and queer theory, while mostly developed in academic circles, has helped create new conceptual spaces for trans politics. I can give a little credit, yeah. I like the time and space to get into a critique and discussion or appraisal of these ideologies, these tendencies of third-wave feminism and queer theory, but other Holly Lewis's book does such good work there, The Politics of Everybody. She gives a Marxist appraisal of these tendencies and provides an encouragement towards what the title describes, The Politics of Everybody. Of everybody. Everybody. All right. Also, this part of the historical narrative is ongoing and likely to be more familiar with folks right now, and we can unpack stuff in discussion. Broadly speaking, though, even with their many limitations, trans activism in these circles of third-wave feminism and queer theory have helped bring trans people back into queer and feminist consciousness, at least at some levels, and given rise to trans-specific academic research and cultural representation. At the same time, the politics of identity enclaves and liberal accommodation that emerged from the decades-long ruling class offensive we call neoliberalism have made all our movements increasingly vulnerable to recapitulation by the market and have intensified state pressure. What victories we have achieved since the mid-1970s were all very hard won. And I'm ahead of the list, I can skip for time. Most of these victories are inaccessible to trans people outside of progressive or urban centers or large workplaces unless these particular trans folks are wealthy and probably or usually white. Most of these victories remain at the level of representation or superficial inclusion on a liberal model of diversity. Trans faces in high places, right? And with the current administration, almost all of these victories are under attack. That attack has not only come in the form of retrograde bathroom bills or the assault on Planned Parenthood, which is one of the few and decreasingly accessible places folks can get trans-competent health care. It's also come in the forms of state and extra-legal violence, housing and employment discrimination, and anti-immigrant policy, among other things, that we are seeing now. Just a few statistics to illustrate. Trans people are more than twice as likely as the rest of the population to be living in poverty at nearly 30%. Trans people of color are over three times as likely to live in poverty. Trans unemployment in general is three times the overall rate, four times if you are trans people of color. Among trans people who are employed in the formal economy, rather than restricted to informal economies like sex work, off the books labor, or crime, I just say unsanctioned capitalist activity. One-third of officially employed, formally employed trans people, and this is just reported, report job discrimination from mistreatment to firing, but mostly firing. 25% report having lost a job to anti-trans bigotry. And in spite of some progress at the level of enforcement, trans workers currently are not formally protected by federal law against job discrimination or housing discrimination. Nearly a third of trans people have experienced homelessness. Over 20% have faced housing discrimination by landlords and lenders, and 70% of homeless trans people have faced mistreatment in shelters. Trans youth are particularly vulnerable and overrepresented among homeless youth overall. Only 11% of trans people have identification documents that reflect their gender identity and chosen name, which turns every interaction relying on ID into a hardship, from employment to education to banking to voting to medical care to buying a damn beer. And this is in addition to the dead naming and misgendering trans people endure at every level of social interaction. And trans people, especially trans women, and even more especially trans women of color, face the constant threat of violence, from verbal assaults to murder. At least 28 trans people were murdered in 2017, reported. 23 of them trans femmes of color. This year, there are already 13 reported murders, 12 of them trans femmes, 10 of them people of color. One was a trans man. Krista Steele Nutzlin, Vicky Gutierrez, Tanya Harvey, Celine Walker, Felicia Mitchell, Zakaria Fry, Amia Berryman, Sasha Wall, Carla Flores Pavon, Nina Fortson, Gigi Pierce, Catalina Christina James, Natasha English, and I'm adding Roxana Hernandez, who died of maltreatment and neglect in ICE custody. That is sure as hell murder. We say their names. The police do not protect trans people. Not only do they not intervene in anti-trans violence, they're often the perpetrators. And as Cece McDonald can tell you, when trans people stand their ground, they are prosecuted for it. And this is especially hard for trans women who are excluded from the official economy and relegated to sex work because of the criminalization of sex work. And that's in addition to the ramping up of all misogyny, but especially trans misogyny and especially racist trans misogyny, on top of the queerphobia, xenophobia, and racism that is part of the latest brutal phase of class war from above, currently waged by the administration of the current president, and I don't have to say his name because fuck that orange hobgoblin. I was going to say shit goblin, but I'm worried that I swear too much. But the point is, things are getting uglier on top of an existing layer of super, super ugly. So that's a bit of the history up to now and some of the politics. I'm going to take my final 5 minutes to talk about Marxist politics and trans liberation. Just putting forth the questions, why must Marxists be in this movement? What is the socialist stake in trans liberation? As to why we stand for trans liberation, socialists must be what Lenin called in the quote, the very long and familiar quote, I'm going to read in its entirety. The tribune of the people, able to react. Yeah, you know it. The tribune of the people, able to react to every manifestation of tyranny and oppression, no matter where it appears, no matter what stratum or class of the people it affects, able to generalize all these manifestations and produce a single picture of police violence and capitalist exploitation, able to take advantage of every event, however small, in order to set forth before all their socialist convictions and their democratic demands, in order to clarify for all and everyone the world historic significance of the struggle for the emancipation of the proletariat. And, I might add, for the emancipation of all humankind. This means that we must fight against all oppression as part of the fight to end capitalism, we know that. When Marxists talk about the proletariat, the working class, we're talking about all the bodies in it, all the genders, all the races, all the nations, every single body subjected to the rule of capital. And when we talk about fighting oppression, like it or not, that means we defend even ruling class trans people against anti-trans bigotry, even if we have to defend our comrades against the predatory ideas and actions of these same people. That is, we have to fight anti-trans bigotry wherever it appears, if we have any claim to being revolutionaries. Right, we know. Okay. It's not just a matter of being a good anti-oppression Marxist, right? Our uncompromising stand on the necessity of trans liberation is rooted in our Marxist-feminist understanding of gender and sexual oppression. Y'all can read about that in detail elsewhere. Go back and listen to Leachy's amazing talk on the gender binary yesterday. Or check out other talks at the conference. But broadly speaking, this system relies on the exploitation of free labor for profit, where workers produce more wealth for their employers than they receive in wages, that they then spend in renewing their capacity to come back to work and do it again. Now, unlike with slave labor or livestock or machines, capitalists don't have to use their own resources to renew our capacity to work. They don't have to fix us when we're broken. They don't pay for that shit. The maintenance of our capacity to labor is our private responsibility, often within a private family or household unit. Now, in this family or household unit, women-identified people still do the lion's share of social reproduction labor. This includes the bearing and rearing of children as future labor, caring for partner and home to renew current labor, caring for elders and disabled family who are excluded from labor, and self-maintaining our own capacity to labor. And for trans folk, coming together as their own families does not actually relieve us from social reproduction. But the bigotry does narrow our possibilities for being able to do it with any facility. All of this surplus labor in producing goods and services and all this reproductive labor is what the capitalist class gets for the bargain basement price of the wages they pay to the employed members of our class, and they can keep these wages as low as possible precisely because social reproduction is unpaid labor in the home and underpaid labor in the workforce, and it's a fucking scam. And in order to maintain this biggest con game in human history, the ruling class has to convince us that there's something natural and necessary in the state of affairs. It has to convince us that this is the natural order of things. Capitalism, like the class-divided societies before it, relies on gender oppression for its very survival. And trans and intersex bodies are, in their very existence, threatening to the upkeep of this millennia-long con job because their gender expression, our gender expression, does not conform to the norms assigned to our bodies. Men who get pregnant, women who don't, and bodies that defy sex gender categorization rules are literally out of order, and thus have the potential to call the entire arrangement into question. So trans oppression is tied to, but not the same as, gender and sexual oppression in general, and our movements have to be tied together as well. And I'm wrapping up. I'm in 30 seconds now, I promise. All right. We must challenge the naturalization of sexism and defend an actual scientific approach to nature, including humans as part of the natural world. Nature does not contain fixed and static bodies, much less fixed and static social categories. I'm skipping a bunch of Engels. Go read Engels, Dialectics of Nature. We must constantly challenge in our thought and action. There's no pure state of nature in which gender exists prior to human activity and social organization. And even our sexed bodies have evolved and changed in their makeup and meanings over human history. So we must challenge the genital essentialism of the fashy bigots on the right and the turfy bigots on the left and uphold the naturalness and gloriousness of human variation. Yeah. I hope CJ blames y'all for me going over. No, I'm kidding. At the same time, look, I'm just going to quote Holly Lewis again. We need, because it's not... it's not the individual trans body, but the entire human social body and its liberation that we're about as socialists. To quote Holly Lewis, we need to organize the whole working class to fight all forms of gender oppression. No individual body is politically radical. No individual body is politically conservative. The united body, the whole people, working to overthrow the system is what counts, and that body is composed of all sorts of individual bodies. I could not agree with her more, so I want to encourage us all to understand how trans oppression is not the natural order of things. It's rooted in both gender oppression and class division historically. It's built into capitalist production and social reproduction today. Thus, the struggle for trans liberation is part of the struggle for all human liberation. Its history is rich and important, and any socialist worth our proud tradition needs to be in that fight. And I encourage trans comrades to join the socialist movement to fight for our own liberation and the overthrow of a system that fucks with us all. An injury to one is an injury to all, and it's going to take us all to realize the full dignity and freedom of our individual bodies, the natural world of which we're a part, and the social body of our species.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.